My name is Dr. Kristen Conti. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I'm a level 5 anger management specialist, which I'm super proud to be and represent. There are just a handful of us in the world. I specialize in working with people convicted of violent crimes. So I do a lot of work in prison systems, maximum security prisons. Recently, the state of Pennsylvania adopted this yield theory that I've created. So I'm going to be training all the Department of Corrections employees in this approach that I developed. And I'm so passionate about the work I do in prisons because nearly 7 out of 10 people who leave prison across the country end up coming back. I believe there's a more effective path to teach people than one that has them turning around doing the same things. My website is Dr. Kristen Conti, C-O-N-T-E, .com, drkristianconti.com. And then I do a YouTube channel, so people can just go to YouTube and type in my name, Dr. Kristen Conti, C-O-N-T-E, and I have a bunch of free videos for people. I just don't feel like there are enough mental health services out there in the world for people, so I kind of just make this channel to help people connect with information that can be helpful for them.
That's fantastic.
So I specialize in working with people convicted of violent crimes. I work with people who have done really some of the most horrific things in society, but not one person I've ever worked with just woke up magically and became like that. There were things that one thing led to the, I always say one thing led to another in the story of everyone's life. There's a reason why people end up where they are.
Well, Dr. Conti, if there was ever a time that we needed your services, this certainly seems to be it because there's a lot of anger out there.
I think on a human level, anger is always there. We have the type of modalities to let it out. For instance, like in today's world, like imagine when we were growing up, if we were upset with something, the only people who knew were the people right around us. But now, if you don't like your meal you get, you can tell the entire world on the internet. I mean, literally tell anyone who has access to the internet anywhere on the planet. And what that's done is started to shape, and especially in the context of anonymity, when we can hide behind a mask or something that doesn't have to show who we really are, it gives people a sense of freedom to say the basest, most, you know, impulsive thoughts they have and think, well, I could just say it because I'm just, you know, an eggshell behind the picture. And so I think it's not necessarily that there's more anger. It's that there's an outlet now for people, and it captures people's attention. Like when people are angry, like the fight or flight response. I mean, look, that's the reason why news channels scroll things at the bottom of their screen, because it captures your attention to say, oh no, I've got a emergency. I've got to tune in. And there's, of course, an emergency every day on every news channel.
Yeah.
It taps into that fight or flight. So I think that we're just more connected, that we can actually see that. I think anger's always been there. And, of course, anger's not wrong or bad. It's what we do with it. Like, anger can be a great teacher. We can learn a lot from it. We don't have to just be reactive to it. We can respond by learning from it.
I think, though, too, that it seems more acceptable now to spew that anger, as it were, in public. I saw somebody who I hadn't seen in a long time on the train this morning, and he sat down and we exchanged pleasantries, and he immediately launched into this rant about politics. I don't ever remember 20 years ago or anything like that. That was an acceptable way in quote unquote polite society to just let it all hang out like that.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think you're 100% right. It's psychological tolerance. So just the way people, when it comes to substance use, they might drink a little bit and then their body gets used to it. It's called tolerance, and then they can handle more. So they take in more, they consume more. The same is true with the psychological tolerance, where you're right, it's acceptable now to just go on the diatribe and talk at people. But here's kind of the point of departure for where yield theory comes in. I created something called yield theory in 1998. I've been developing it, refining it for the last 21 years. This new book is Walking Through Anger is all about teaching the world what yield theory is. Here's what it is in a nutshell. When we communicate with people, let's say a bear walked in the room. Well, if a bear walked in the room, your fight or flight response is going to go off, and you're going to start to be defensive and either flee or fight or freeze. Mm-hmm. But the same is true, and this is fascinating. Whether a bear comes in the room Or, for instance, like your experience on the train, whether someone brings up politics and your brain responds in the same way, defensive, it sends out, and we tend to shut down. And so what yield theory is, it's about connecting with people in a way that helps us lead with compassion and conscious education, get around that fight or flight response and speak so that we can actually be heard. Because we live in a world where people are comfortable with just saying whatever they want to say, but are you really speaking in a way that your message is getting through to others? And that's what I try to help people do.
Well, in your book, you talk about anger as a practice.
Let's say with young people, if someone out there listening has children, you say, well, I want to teach my children to play an instrument. One of the things you're going to say to them is, look, the way to get really good at it is to practice. The more you practice, and the more you practice in the most effective way, the better you're going to get at it. Mm-hmm. If you practice poor habits, you're going to get really good at doing poor habits. Well, just as we would say that to our young people as they start to learn an instrument or a sport or something new, the reality is that we all master what we practice. And so if we practice being impulsive, if we practice lashing out, if we practice gossiping and being negative, we're going to get really good at that. But if we can be mindful to practice handling our emotions, our intense emotions, in the most conscious way possible, then we're going to get really good at that too. So I really emphasize that we master what we practice, so be mindful of what we're practicing.
And how does non-attachment come in?
I really think I've tried to always make things really simple and explain things in the most pragmatic way possible. And so when I break down what yield theory is, I say, you know, ultimately, I do three core actions. I listen, I validate, and I explore options. And it seems simple, but those three core actions are driven by seven fundamental components, the most important of which, I believe, is non-attachment. And so I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think that even though we all know that we listen and we validate and we explore options, we also know that the way we listen, the way we validate, and the way we explore options makes all the difference. And non-attachment is simply this. You know that you're not your piece of jewelry. So if you lose a piece of jewelry, that doesn't, you're not less of a person. Mm-hmm. You're not your things. And I think we have even though sometimes that gets blurred for some people, I think most people can understand that pretty easily. You are not your things. If you lose a possession, you're not less of a person. But the same is true of our thoughts. I mean, think about this. We all would say, oh, I still have more to learn. As long as I'm alive, I have more to learn. But the moment we encounter someone who thinks, feels, believes, behaves differently from us, all of a sudden, we don't think we have more to learn. We think we just want to tell them how they're wrong.
Yeah.
So if we could maintain non-attachment even to our thoughts and realizing, look, these are the thoughts. These are what I believe right here and now. But I'm open that I could learn something new in the next moment that could teach me something entirely differently.
You said you did a lot of work with yield theory with prisoners in Pennsylvania. I can't even imagine what inmates go through. Do a lot of them, are they still sitting there stewing and marinating in their anger rather than going forward at all?
Some very much so. Sometimes you get to a point where, and I do work throughout the whole country in different prisons, and certain states, life means life. You know, there's no chance of parole. And at some stage for people who have been convicted of a life sentence, they go through what I would call acceptance, where they recognize this is going to be my life. And so it's not necessarily anger at that point anymore. But there are some people who definitely stew in anger. I'm going to give you a practical example of how non-attachment might work.
Okay.
I was in a supermax prison, and there was a man who probably had 200 plus assaults on officers, on other inmates. So he's in a restricted housing unit, or what you'd know as the hole, solitary confinement, which in many institutions isn't necessarily you off in a room in a basement. It's you're on a unit where all the doors face each other, so people end up like arguing all day. It's one of the loudest parts of most prisons because a lot of times guys who are in there, they don't have anything else to do, so they're arguing with each other all day. But this one guy, so he was really tough for the officers to deal with, and he was outside in the yard. And yard in solitary confinement is really just a very small cage. It's like a 8x10 space where there's a cage. You can kind of look up and see the sky, but there's cement all around you. So he was the last man out in the yard, and an officer came in and said, I'm not dealing with this. He said, this is ridiculous. He said he just he looked and he did, I tried to say something to him. He just looked away and spit. Mm-hmm. And this was like a brand new officer. So they said, Doc, can you go talk to him? So I said, all right. So I walked out there and I looked at him and I said, he was the only one out there. It was just he and I. And I said, man, it's nice weather out here. I was just trying to start the conversation. So I started to say a couple of things and he looked off to the side and just spit. And I looked at him and in that moment, instead of thinking he should be listening to me, he doesn't know I'm here, all this. I said, no, let me get non-attached to what I'm doing, let go of my approach. And said, I looked at him and I said, oh man, I'm so sorry. I just realized I didn't even introduce myself. Like I came into your space and didn't even introduce myself. My name is Dr. Conti. I come into these prisons for 6 months at a time. I work with staff. I work with inmates. So anyway, he kind of turns and he can't help hold in the smile and he smiles and he said, man, I've been down for 20 years and no, I've never encountered staff that apologized. And I said, well, I was wrong. I came into your space and just assumed you were going to start talking to me. And so I needed to let go of that approach and see, kind of meet you where you actually are, not where I wanted you to be. And we ended up having a really good connection from that. But that's an example of, like, instead of me thinking the problem's someone else, letting go of my attachment to my approach and just making an honest assessment, is what I'm doing working? Am I getting through to the other person? Because honestly, Pat, that's the key. When we communicate in any area of our lives, do we speak just to be like, I told them, or do we actually want to make an impact?
Were you an angry guy when you began your career? Is that what led you to focus on anger?
No. And, you know, it's fascinating because a lot of people get into psychology because they want to fix their own issues. Yeah. I got into psychology because my dad was an earth scientist. So My dad, when I was a teenager, I said to my dad, why do you study rocks? You know, and he said, I loved literature. I loved storytelling, but I just didn't see the excitement in that. So I said, why do you study? And I was a hothead teenager, haughty type teenager, like any teenager. So my dad looked at me and he said, well, if you're only going to live on one planet your entire life, don't you think you ought to get to know that planet? I was like, man, that's great advice. So then when I was studying in college, I thought, I've kind of lost. I thought, you know what? I'm only ever going to live with me. So why don't I get to know myself more? And I started to study psychology. So I didn't really come in with, like, this was an issue. I can't give you a solid reason for why prison. I mean, I'm a 6 foot, 250 pound bald guy with a beard tattoo.
Yes,
so,
I saw
and
you.
I don't dress up.
So, I would think that would help, right? I mean,
it does help me. It does help me. I'll be honest. It does help me. Because when I go in, like, I probably look intimidating, but the reality is, I'm all about compassion, conscious education. So it's not that I don't have anger. Of course I have anger. Of course Everyone does. But it wasn't like an issue that was like getting me in trouble or something like that. I think I was really drawn to the fact that I had a center in South Lake Tahoe for guys who were convicted of violent crimes. And these guys, they would graduate my group. They would get off parole and they would come back voluntarily to these groups. And I just thought this was a niche for me. This kind of worked because, you know, I give these guys real life stuff that, like, really practical techniques that work.
And you are a certified level 5 anger management specialist. And you were saying that there aren't very many of you around.
I think there are 4 of us. And
wow.
And I'm definitely the youngest by a bit. But I love and admire everyone else that is. And I'm super grateful to have that. I put my heart and soul into this. You know, I have more than 20,000 hours of clinical experience. So I used to be a professor, and I taught counseling for years. And I would say to my students, if you ever ask me if something's going to be on the test, just drop out of this. Just drop out of the program. Don't even drop out of my class. Drop out of the program, because here's the reality. I want to ask you this. Which client do you plan to see down the road for the rest of your career that you can look at in the eyes and say, you know, I didn't really study your issue or how to help you, so I'm not going to, you know, I didn't pay attention in class that day. I said, you're not going to want to sit with that with anybody. And if you can think of somebody that you wouldn't care if you helped or not, then this isn't the right profession for you. So I always put a lot of passion into reading voraciously, studying, and I wanted to be able to help people in the most genuine way.
You know, one of the things that used to, it was a source of laughter, but one of the things that bothered me about Woody Allen's movies over the years was his character would always be going to a shrink for 30 years. And not getting anything really out of it, feeling the same way at age 60 that he did at 25. What do you say about that in your line of work?
Oh, my gosh. If I don't see people that I'm here to help. I found a niche early on. I was like, I'm going to help people and I'm going to help them not need me. And then they end up spreading the word, and I never wanted for clients my whole career because of that. So I think if you're in the same predicament doing the same thing over and over again with the same result, it's probably not real healthy for you. Isn't that the definition, the colloquial definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? So I think, you know, sometimes it's a matter of, as a therapist, to say, look, I've taken you as far as I can take you. It seems like this is time for you to move on to someone else. That might be able to give you insight differently from how I am, because apparently I'm not doing a job of helping you gain the type of insight to get you to where you want to be. So that's what I would kind of guide. And if there are people out there with those long-term clients, say, stop. We got to ask ourselves, what are we doing? Because our goal is to help people not be dependent on us, but to help people. That's why technically counselors are trained to not give advice. Not never. There are moments, hey, put that gun down. Hey, hey, step away from that. There are moments where you're going to give advice. But for the most part, you don't. The reason why is if you give advice and people take it and it doesn't work, they blame you for their decisions. And if you give it and it does work, now you made them dependent on you. And that's not the goal of it. The goal is to make them independent.
Do you find that domestic violence cases are especially tough nuts to crack, or is it just dealing with anger in a different kind of guise?
No, it's sometimes it can be very tough to crack. I mean, I have a knack for that in particular because I, you know, with my size, I think that does help me, because a lot of times men who are committing these domestic violence crimes are, if we probably just did a quick glance at a room full of guys, a lot of times guys are smaller and they're, you know, they're insecure and they're lashing out, trying to hurt others. And when you see some of, and no, I'm not saying this is all the time by any stretch of the means, but I think it kind of helps me, because when I'm, as being bigger, guys will come in and I'm like, listen, I've been married for 19 years happily. Like, my wife and I literally have never called each other a name. Because there's no reason to call a name. You objectify somebody when you call them a name. This is your loved one. Why would you objectify him? So, and then I give him real life stuff. And the other thing is this, that I do well with in terms of the domestic violence counseling. It's, I acknowledge that everyone plays a role. And that can sound like, oh my gosh, what are you saying? Someone causes violence. No, never. No one ever causes someone to hurt them. No one ever is to blame for that. But it's disempowering to tell people that they don't play any role, because then they're saying you have no worth, no value in this interaction. The reality is everyone does play a role, and if you can learn what role you play and how you can either help you break free from that relationship, or what role you play so that you can find a different path so that you're not hurting other people, that's powerful. So this, you know, domestic violence is awful and we see it everywhere. I'm really passionate about that kind of stuff. Most of the guys who were convicted of the violent crimes in California in my groups for outpatient were domestic violence cases. And, you know, look, I teach some real stuff, like it's on a continuum. It's just the way you go see a movie and there's more blood, more guts in the sequel. You know, right? There's always more explosions because, again, that's psychological tolerance. Same thing happens with relationships. If you call your loved one, you call your wife a name. Okay, so then what happens? Over time, that doesn't release all the energy, so now you have to step it up. So maybe you stand over her and intimidate her. Maybe you grab her and hold, you know, like maybe you say, oh, I'm just restraining her. We minimize stuff. And then it goes more and more until eventually people commit these, like, awful things where they're physically hurting and killing their partners out of domestic violence. But what I do is I use what I call a continuum of violence to say, look, we're all on this continuum. What I need you to do is be mindful about where you are and how you can back yourself back down it.
This has been so much fun and such a fascinating conversation. I thank you for taking the time to talk to me this morning. Is there anything that you would like to add about your book or about anger that we may have touched on that you want to underline before we conclude?
I do. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I genuinely appreciate this.
Oh, thank you.
This is my legacy book. It's called Walking Through Anger. It is, I'm a storyteller, so I tell lots of Zen tales and Aesop's fables and my own stories and lots of clinical examples, like I told you from the case I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So I have lots of like interesting stories in it, and I feel proud of that, to be able to offer that to people. But the one thing that I would give that I really would love to reach into listeners' hearts and have them feel is this. The next time you're in an emotional experience, whatever it is, anger, could be sadness, could be anxiety, please know this. There is a beginning, a middle, and an end to every emotional experience, which means your emotions, they're going to come and go, but what you do, your actions, they can't be undone. So my hope is to have people be as mindful as possible as they go through that beginning, middle, and end of their emotion, so that they can not only find peace, but become a source of peace for others.